Support for this podcast comes from Wise, one account for over 50 currencies. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all from your Wise account. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
Today, a special edition of The World, Animals All Around Us. We go to an animal rescue center in Sudan.
It's a female hyena. She's about 1 year old.
That hyena's name is Beta.
Also on the show, do lobsters feel pain?
Something that actually reacts by flipping their tail when they're in hot water. That's interpreted by humans as a painful end-of-life experience.
I'm Marco Werman. It's Labor Day, and we're devoting our show to animals. Like the mountain goats that took over a town in Wales and decided to live it up a bit.
Everything that you think a goat would do to have fun, they were doing it. they're just destroying everything they possibly could.
Plus, ugly animals. They just need support, love, and a little rebranding. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Labor Day. We hope you're able to take the day off, this holiday that celebrates workers. It occurs to me there's a whole world out there that does not get the day off for the various kinds of work it does, and that's the animal kingdom. So we thought on this Labor Day, let's pull together a few of our favorite stories about animals. We're going to start things off at an animal rescue center in Sudan. The center is a labor of love for the team there. It is also a popular spot with visitors. The world's Halima Gikandi dropped by this past spring.
On the outskirts of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, families with children walk around a large field, looking curiously at a menagerie of wild animals. This is the Sudan Animal Rescue. Osman Salah is the founder.
Right now we have 10 acres that we've developed. We have about 17 lions, 6 hyenas, as well as gazelles, snakes, ostriches, monkeys, and different types of species.
As you can guess by the name, the Sudan Animal Rescue takes in at-risk animals from across Sudan.
The first campaign started in January 2020. I visited a local park and I found that they had a lot of animals, including 5 lions that were in really bad shape and starving, just skin on bones.
Salah, who has a background in software engineering, started posting pictures of these emaciated lions on social media. It got a lot of attention in Sudan and around the world. Salah learned about lots of neglected wildlife in animal parks and zoos in Sudan.
All these animal parks suffered because there weren't any visitors and there wasn't any funding from the government.
So he decided to create a space to relocate these animals. Flash forward to 2 years later, those once-starving lions now roam healthily here at the center. It's become a popular place for families and school children. For many Sudanese visitors, it's the first time they're getting to see native wildlife up close. In one corner, children peer and laugh, pointing to cockatiels, parakeets, and other colorful birds. In a different enclosure, one animal takes a special interest in my microphone. It begins to sniff out of curiosity. Can you guess which animal this is by the sound it makes? It's a female hyena. She's about 1 year old.
That hyena's name is Beta. She was in a home in Khartoum. Somebody kept her as a pet from a very young age. And he had her literally tied with a chain and a collar in his garden. And she was getting bigger and older.
That's when the owner quickly gave up his pet hyena to the Sudan Animal Rescue. Salah tells me that keeping wild animals like Beta as pets is a big problem in Sudan. Now she's enjoying the good life here.
She's really domesticated and you just feel you're dealing with a dog. She really craves attention and loves, all these back rubs and playing around. But at the end of the day, she's a wild animal and they're unpredictable.
I asked Salah how people react to him and his volunteers rescuing all of these animals at a time when many Sudanese are struggling to put food on the table. He tells me responses are mixed.
Most of the people are happy with it. Some people are, you know, being a bit selfish. I think they keep saying that, you know, there's human beings in need.
He tells people that protecting Sudan's environment is important, too. The country has already lost a great deal of its wildlife.
Because of all the civil wars and the droughts, we lost a lot of the animals, including like elephants and giraffes and rhinos.
Saleh says he hopes the Sudan Animal Rescue can be the starting point for raising awareness and one day growing a local tourism industry around the country's wildlife. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Khartoum, Sudan.
Over the past year in Great Britain, there's been a growing awareness about lobsters and other crustaceans, whether or not they feel pain. Parliament in London debated that question and ultimately sided with the lobsters, that yes, they do in fact feel pain. In early April, the British House of Lords passed the Animal Welfare Sentience Bill. Crabs and lobsters are now protected by law and classified as sentient beings. From London, the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry covered the debate for us.
Nigel Bloxham runs the Crab House Cafe at the famous Chesil Beach in southwest England, where they only sell fish that's locally caught.
We sell crabs and lobsters and other shellfish such as mussels and oysters, clams. We sell any fish that swims past us, either in the lagoon or in the channel.
Bloxham has been cooking up all kinds of seafood for years. When he started out, he says, he always boiled lobsters alive.
Yeah, it was the way the books told us to do it. You know, it was the way we were shown to do it back along, you know.
And that's how he cooked crabs too.
If you put a crab into boiling water, it will shoot all its legs. It's trying to escape, you know, it will throw its legs off its body.
It's descriptions like these that are upsetting some British lawmakers. They're currently deciding on the terms of the UK's new Animal Welfare Sentience Bill. But what does sentient actually mean?
In general terms, what it means is that a creature is capable of experiencing pain and pleasure.
Maisie Tomlinson lobbies for the humane treatment of crustaceans, with a group called Crustacean Compassion.
You know, you wouldn't expect to be able to buy a live rabbit from a butcher's and then store it in your fridge for several days and then kill it by boiling it alive. There would be an absolute outcry. So really, we're talking about relatively small tweaks, particularly at the fishing end of things.
Tomlinson is thrilled at the way the debate is going in the UK. Because of Brexit, Britain is no longer subject to the European Union's animal welfare standards and is now drawing up its own laws. The Animal Welfare Sentience Bill is making its way through Parliament, and it's fired up lawmakers like Baroness Janet Fuchs.
I have been shocked by some of the treatment of animals such as lobsters, crabs, squid and so on, by the way they have been stored and very often killed. There was one horrible example of a supermarket tightly wrapping a crab, a live crab, in one-use plastic. A double abomination, as far as I'm concerned.
Fellow peers also cited the Oscar-winning film My Octopus Teacher as proof that even mollusks have feelings. The documentary follows the unusual relationship between filmmaker Craig Foster and an octopus.
You can compare her intelligence to a cat or a dog or even to one of the lower primates. A mollusk shouldn't be this intelligent.
There are scientific studies that suggest lobsters do feel pain, but not all scientists are so sure. Robert Stenick has been studying lobsters in the waters off the coast of Maine for almost 30 years.
I don't know exactly how one differentiates between reacting to a stimulus and what we think of as pain. You know, my sense has always been that for organisms with higher cognitive capacity, you feel pain so that you can learn and remember and avoid it in the future. Lobster's ability to learn is modest, but it's not zero. And so I really don't know.
Stenick is professor of marine sciences at the University of Maine. He says he often wonders why other shellfish are barely mentioned in these debates.
A lot of people don't think anything of boiling clams or eating oysters, even eating oysters raw, because they share so few characters that are identifiable to humans, whereas something that has eyes and it has claws that some people might think of as hands, something that actually reacts by flipping their tail when they're in hot water, that's interpreted by humans as a painful end-of-life experience.
Some British lawmakers are inclined to agree. Lord Daniel Moylan says he worries that including invertebrates in the sentience bill is just going too far.
The clause that strikes me as most extravagant is the one that gives the Secretary of State the unfettered power to declare, should he wish, that an earthworm is a sentient being. My lords, this is a power greater than that given by God to Adam in the Garden of Eden.
British anglers too say they're concerned about what the new law might mean for them and how it might infringe on their way of life. Crabhouse Cafe owner Nigel Bloxham says he hasn't made up his mind about the bill just yet.
I don't know. I think I'm in favour of it. I mean, yes, I can see that if we're killing for food, we ought to think about doing it humanely anyway. You know, as humane as we can.
These days, Bloxham uses a device called a crustacean to kill the lobsters. It zaps them with an electric current. He says that knocks them out in under a second. But there's a catch. The crustacean retails at more than $3,000. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Mosquitoes. They're darn right annoying. The bites itch, and some can be deadly. One species in particular carries Zika, dengue, and yellow fever. Those viruses cause birth defects, sickness, and death in tropical regions in the Americas, Africa, and Asia. The World's Stephen Snyder recently looked into new research that shows how this one mosquito is so effective at targeting humans.
Its name is Aedes aegypti.
It's a human specialist.
This human specialist's ability to target humans was the focus of a team of researchers, including Princeton PhD candidate Jessica Zong.
You probably know, like, they detect CO2, they detect heat, they use vision. But one thing that's actually quite important for them is olfaction.
Olfaction, the sense of smell. Zong's job was to collect samples of odors to test on the mosquitoes.
In order to get human body odor, you want people to be as stinky as possible.
And so human volunteers were recruited.
So we decided, like, 3 days no showering. That's, you know, reasonable. Most people would be probably willing to do that, at least for science.
Next step, blow air across people's bodies to collect the odors. They had to step into a body bag to do that.
The person strips down naked, goes into this bag, just their head poking out. There's a little blanket on top for modesty's sake. And then the person will lie there for 2 hours.
Song collected the odors of people, plus dogs, sheep, guinea pigs, quail, and rats, to be sniffed in the lab by specially bred mosquitoes. Another team member monitored a mosquito's brain activity while it was exposed to different smells.
We want to open up their head and try to figure out what they are thinking when they smell humans.
Tsule Chow, now at Cornell, was a member of the Princeton team. He bred genetically modified mosquitoes whose microscopic brains would be illuminated, like a light bulb, when their olfactory neurons were stimulated. He also performed surgery on each mosquito subject.
So what we need to do is we need to open up the head, use like very tiny forceps. Just open it up so the brain is exposed.
Yep, tiny forceps. We're talking about the head of a mosquito.
So you need to be very gentle under the microscope.
And what Chow saw under the microscope was surprising. The mosquito was being exposed to lots of different animal odors, so he was expecting dozens of parts of the mosquito brain to light up in response. But instead, just two of the mosquito's nerve centers were affected.
One of those only responded to human odor.
That's the Princeton lab director, Professor Lindy McBride. She says that the other stimulus to excite the mosquito was carbon dioxide, which comes from the breath of humans, of course, but from every other animal as well.
The fact that these two compounds are quite abundant in a blend that is otherwise animal-like indicates that it's a human odor.
And that's what the mosquito named Aedes aegypti is looking for. The team's paper, published this month in the journal Nature, is raising more questions, like how did this human-seeking behavior evolve in this species of mosquito, and why? And now that we know which chemical this mosquito is sniffing for, how can this knowledge be used to prevent diseases that continue to ravage many parts of the world? For The World, this is Stephen Snyder.
Coming up, that time when goats took over a village in Wales, plus more stories about the animals we love, and a few that can be a little annoying. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We love animals, but let's face it, sometimes they can be pests. These next two stories are about what happens when they start to just get, how do I put this, too much to take. First, we head to Llandudno, a seaside town in Wales. That's where a herd of wild goats overran the town during a COVID lockdown in 2020. At the time, I spoke with video producer Andrew Stewart there. He described the scene.
I live in a pub in Llandudno, and I was just downstairs one night. I looked outside the window, straight onto the street, and there they were, literally running past me, about 10 or 15 of them all together. They stopped in the square, which is about 50 yards or so away from us, and just started eating all the hedges, climbing on the walls, blocking the roads, and just like having the time of their lives. Like everything that you think a goat would do to have fun, they were doing it, you know. they just destroying everything they possibly could.
Where did these goats come from? Have they ever visited the town before?
They do visit regularly, actually. So we're a coastal resort, and it's about 20,000 or so people. Mm. And we've got a headland, which is it's about a five or six mile drive around it. And that's about 600 feet high. They live on the cliffs on there, basically, and they've lived there since about the 1800s. They normally live on the cliffs, but when it gets really windy, which it has been for a bit recently, they come down for shelter. Mm. And normally they come down and they get to sort of people's back gardens and streets and sort of the back streets. And then there's cars and people in the way to stop them going any further. They seem to be a bit averse to people. They don't really like it. You're not going to come close to them because they don't like you as much as you wouldn't like to have a meeting with one of them in close quarters. But I mean, because of lockdown, there's no people, there's no cars, there's no noise, there's nothing to stop them. So they're just exploring places which they haven't done before.
How have the locals reacted? Are people giving them space or trying to get them to go back to the cliff?
You can get them to go back. They sort of go back on their own. They know where they live and they're going to go back up there. But people love it, you know. It's just absolutely taken off. I mean, my Twitter account has been pretty much unusable for the last day or so, with everyone sharing that those videos. There was even a goat cam set up on one of the tourist pages for the town, a Facebook Live of the square where they're looking down. And, you know, just so people can keep an eye on that and see them as they come back in real time.
Now you're known around the world, as you put it in one tweet, as the man who stares at goats. How does that feel?
Yes. Well, it's a very memorable lockdown for that, for sure. You think, what could possibly come out of lockdown? What's going to happen? I did not think that this would happen. It's just so weird and bizarre and really funny at the same time.
That's video producer Andrew Stewart speaking with me in 2020 from his home in Llandudno, Wales, after his town was overrun by goats. More recently, there's another area being overrun by animals, rabbits to be exact. Farmers around Lleida in northeast Spain say these culprits are wreaking havoc on their farmland. Thanks to the rabbits, farmers are likely to lose most of their harvest this year, from peaches to pistachios, olives to grapes. Jerry Haddon filed this report from the village of Verdoux.
There's another one. At midday during a sweltering heat wave, farmers Ramon Bonet, Ramon Boleda, and Juan Bonet would normally be heading from their fields to the shade of the village bar. But today they're stuck driving around, counting rabbits. We spot dozens of them, scampering among the crops, darting in and out of underground warrens. We stop on the edge of a vineyard. Something here is very wrong. The rabbits have chewed the skin off the vine, says Boleda. This vine is done for. This entire harvest is lost, he says. The plantations around Lleida are sometimes called Europe's fruit basket. There are millions of dollars at stake here, as well as the supply of many farm products for shoppers from Berlin to Budapest. A short drive away, Boleda finds new losses among his pistachio trees. The rabbits eat the bark all around the trunk, he says. They've destroyed more than 400 trees. Boleda says that's about $100,000 down the rabbit hole, and the plague is getting worse. There are now up to 1,000 rabbits per square kilometer here, farmers say. 50 is the acceptable number, says the government. Everyone agrees the bunnies need to be culled. The problem is how to do it. After the drive around, Ramon Bonet tests his 12-gauge shotgun. He says rabbits have always lived in Iberia. In 300 BC, the Carthaginians named the peninsula Hispania, or Land of Rabbits, and it stuck. So humans and bunnies have long coexisted, but recent hotter temperatures are causing rabbits to reproduce faster. And Bonet says the pandemic hasn't helped. During these years of COVID restrictions, he says, no one was out hunting. Plus, there are just fewer hunters in general. Our average age is now over 60. There are no more young people, he says, and yet the rabbits keep coming. But hunting is the only tool farmers have. Antoni Torres is the local hunting warden. He says in this county alone, rabbits have overrun 99% of the farmland. We'd need to double the number of hunters, he says, to reduce rabbit numbers. But then you create other problems. You can't have that many people with guns hunting at once, he says. We need to be able to put out poison, interjects Ramon Bonet. Either they die or we do. That's exactly what was written on a giant sign residents woke up to on a recent Sunday. It was hanging from this bridge on the edge of town. Farmers or rabbits, it read. And there was something else. They hung actual rabbits off the bridge, says a local bakery worker named Eva. Dead rabbits, to be precise, with ropes around their necks. That's a bit sadistic, Eva says, don't you think? But I do support the protests. Poor guys. The anonymous gesture attracted TV crews and sparked a minor, unexpected backlash in the village. The next day, the animal rights folks had hung their own sign, says farmer Juan Bonet. It said, to protest, you don't need to shed blood. It had a picture of a bunny giving us the finger, he says. The farmers here will keep protesting, as they did recently, driving through town on their tractors, and they'll keep suffering huge losses. They hope that if shoppers find less produce to choose from this fall, society might support them in their fight to keep rabbits in check. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Verdú, Spain.
We were talking earlier about how mosquitoes are able to sniff out humans. The singer Zao from Congo knows how dangerous they can be. He even wrote a hit song about it. Here's Zao's Moustique from 2005. Moustique, moustique, tu es un bandit. Moustique, moustique, tu es un salaud. Tu me piques, moi je dors pas, tu es un salaud. Tu suces mon sang, tu amènes dans les usines où on fabrique du vin rouge. Still to come on this Labor Day special, what ugly fish have to put up with. You're with The World. The language of chimpanzees. It's more complex than we humans think. Plus, itty-bitty orange toads.
They're cute frogs. They're just adorable.
They may be cute, but oddly, there's one thing they cannot do. The stories and more from the animal kingdom coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Our Labor Day show today is taking a pause from human news and focusing instead on the animal kingdom, both present and past. You know, we humans have a visual record of our forebears. Neanderthals left behind cave paintings for experts to discover. They enable us to contemplate what life was like in prehistoric times. Animals also left behind traces of their lives. In southern Brazil, scientists have discovered thousands of massive burrows. These tunnels, dug by prehistoric animals, could be at least 12,000 years old. For paleontologists, it's a big discovery and is opening up a whole new branch of their field of study. Michael Fox brought us this report from Florianópolis, Brazil.
I'm standing near the side of a major interstate highway in southern Brazil, BR-116. It feels like an industrial wasteland. There's car parts stores, broken down building behind me, spray-painted front walls, concrete crumbling, grass and weeds sprouting its way up through the concrete. And yet it was here, just down the street, that Heinrich Frank made his first big discovery a decade ago.
Como é que pode, né? E foi exatamente essa situação. Eu passo na rodovia, Geologist Heinrich Frank says, I was on the highway going 60 miles an hour on a Friday afternoon, and I saw this excavation with a hole. So I went there and saw it was a tunnel. A paleoburrow. That's a burrow made by a prehistoric animal, likely an armadillo or an extinct giant ground sloth. These types of sloths were huge, some the size of a modern-day elephant, so you can imagine the size of their burrows. Almost 2,000 paleoburrows have been found across southern South America, mostly in the Brazilian states of Santa Catarina and Rio Grande do Sul, which border Uruguay and Argentina. Frank and his team at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul have found the majority of them. I had to see one for myself. From the end of the road near a village named Nova Homa, it takes several hours to hike in. The trail winds up a valley, passing back and forth over a river which meanders downstream. We pass up through lush tropical vegetation, and before us is a massive hole in the side of the hill.
Bacana, cara. Meu Deus.
The main gallery of this paleoburrow is huge. The ceiling is maybe 2 or 3 stories high, with 4 tunnels leading off in different directions. This is amazing, I tell my guide. This is one of the largest and most well-known paleoburrows. Most don't have such a complex system. For decades, local residents said these tunnels were dug by the Xokleng indigenous peoples in order to hide out when under attack by colonizing Europeans. But Frank and his team said it was clearly a paleoburrow. You can tell by the claw marks. They're the most defining feature of many paleoburrows found across the region. Scientists say they are the mark of the giant ground sloth. We walk through one of the tunnels. It's just under my height, so I have to bend over slightly. And there they are. Deep, parallel gashes scrape across the ceiling and sides of the cave. It's awe-inspiring. But alongside the claw marks is something else. Initials, names, and words carved into the sandstone walls, left there by human visitors. It's been really degraded since the first time I came here, says my guide, Marcelo Crepaldi, as we walk back down the trail. When I was first here in the 1990s with a local school trip, there were no marks or names. Now, there are even walls collapsing from being messed with. Frank's university group, the Paleoburrows Project, has waged a campaign to raise awareness about the existence of paleoburrows. But it's an uphill battle, particularly amid major budget cuts to education, research, and grants. His team is also fighting time. Remember the first paleoburrow he found on the side of the highway? It was one of more than 15 they located in that same area. There were condominiums of giant armadillos there, says Frank. But today, you go there and there's nothing. Houses have been built on top. There are retaining walls. People are living on top of them. That's the contradiction in paleoburrow research. It's development, new houses, highway expansion that often cuts into the ground and makes it possible to discover these burrows. But once they're open, it's only a matter of time until most are destroyed by the elements, rain or construction. Frank isn't deterred.
A importância das paleotocas é basicamente porque você consegue.
He says, this is so important because you can reconstruct the home of a prehistoric animal. This research doesn't exist in any branch of paleontology. You have the dinosaurs, you have their bones, but you don't know where they lived. Not us. We find their home. Our group is on the new frontier in this area. That's their challenge, he says, developing methods of research in this new field, documenting each location before it's gone. For the world, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Okay, if chimpanzees were having a picnic on this Labor Day, this is how they'd tell their friends about it. That's a chimpanzee announcing, here's a food treat, come on over. Yep, it turns out chimpanzees use 400 vocal sequences to communicate, sort of like how we use words. We know that thanks to recent research published in the journal Communications Biology. Catherine Crockford was co-author of the study. She's research director at CNRS Institute of Cognitive Sciences in Lyon, France. And describe for us exactly what the chimpanzees were saying in that exchange we just heard.
There we have females sitting in the top of a food tree. They've just had another party of chimpanzees 200 meters away who are coming towards them, and they have produced an invitation to join them. It's panted hoos with a single hoo on the end. So this would be classed as a call sequence. It's very hard to equate yet to things like words or sentences. So we prefer to call it a call sequence because at the moment we know something about its structure, but it's still some way off until we know what the sequences really mean.
So we heard that vocal sequence a moment ago. I'd like us to hear another example. So what's going on there, Catherine?
Right. So this is an example of five different call types combined together. It is an adolescent male greeting, first of all, the dominant male of the group, and he's meeting him as well. So he hasn't seen him for a day. So you hear this whole sequence unfold of what he's doing.
So what are the things do chimps kind of communicate about?
So animals tend to communicate a little bit about what they see, for example, predators, and also about what they do, usually in social interaction. Chimpanzees go a little bit beyond that, potentially, because they seem to talk about more things that they're doing. So I'm grooming, I'm playing, I'm nesting, and I'm feeding, and I'm resting. So they have maybe more possibilities in their repertoire of things that they talk about.
And what distinguishes a chimpanzee word? Again, I'm going to use that word. Is it pitch, duration? I mean, what's the range and ability of their vocal cords?
They're probably not words. And one reason to say that is that if you look at chimpanzees all over the world, they will have a similar repertoire. So it's not like language where we can, each culture, people develop and learn the words that they hear around them for their own language, right? So chimpanzees are much more constrained than that. And primates in general, which has kind of been why there's this big conundrum about how language evolved in humans.
So, Catherine, not to get overly anthropomorphic about what this chimp communication means, but it is kind of incredible. How did these findings change your own thinking about chimpanzees and how close they really are to Homo sapiens?
We're opening up something here that is very promising. We need to know, with these 390 utterances, how many of them are changing the meaning of, for example, the single unit, like a grunt or a hoo or a bark or a scream, and then you combine them together. Does that then change the meaning? If we see evidence of that, then that starts to really be a game changer in terms of these evolutionary processes towards the evolution of language. But that's a step that we haven't yet reached.
Catherine Crockford joined us from Lyon, France. She's co-director of the Thai Chimpanzee Project. Catherine, this is fascinating. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure to share news from the African jungle.
Animals show up in the unlikeliest of places. We've seen them return to urban centers during the pandemic. Ray Barreto, the late great Puerto Rican band leader who infused New York City with unforgettable salsa and boogaloo, must have imagined an elephant marching through New York. Going back to 1971, this is O Elefante. It goes without saying that there's a lot of research going on about animals and animal behavior. But we don't often hear about research on how humans perceive what animals look like. I mention this because earlier this year, researchers from the University of Montpellier in France wanted to know which fish the public thought most deserved conservation. The prettiest, most colorful ones came out on top. So what does that mean for less attractive fish? They may not get the beauty vote, and yet they're critical for healthy ecosystems. Diogo Verissimo has studied the plight of ugly animals in the conservation world. He's a fellow in the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford. I started by asking how bad ugly animals have it when it comes to conservation.
It is simply impossible to overcome the fact that there's differences in perceptions. We perceive different animals differently. We perceive some animals as being, you know, more beautiful, more aesthetically appealing than others. And that is not something we can change. What we can change, though, is a number of other ways in which we perceive animals. So maybe the ones that are not necessarily just related to physical attributes, because, of course, preference or our preference for this animal or that animal is not just about the aesthetics. There's a number of different things. And so some species, for example, might have attributes, for example, that resemble in some ways our own lives or things we go through. So, for example, you know, famously, of course, when we talk about elephants, we talk about dolphins, for example, we often talk about their social behavior, right? The interactions between individuals, right? The name that we give an animal might be something that we can, not all names are created equal, and we can potentially change and tweak a species name to try to give it a little bit more of a oomph, a little bit of more of a sort of presence in the public eye, which of course often equals sort of higher priority when it comes to conservation.
So you talked about renaming ugly animals. I think of the blobfish, which looks just like its name. It's a pale pink blob, and yet it's endangered. So unattractive, in fact, that its appearance actually helped photographs of it go viral on the internet. What lessons are there to be learned with the blobfish? Like, what should we rename it?
You know, the fact that we are right now talking about it, it means that it is possible for those species to have a little bit of attention from the public and from decision makers. So, you know, beyond that, I think it's also important to, you know, recognize that we won't be able to design sort of a marketing pitch for every single species out there. But that's okay as well, because we have these species, you know, we call flagship species that we can use to gather support for broader conservation efforts that have benefits beyond themselves. So, for example, if you take a case of Rwanda with gorillas, for example, you know, the entire protected area of Rwanda is funded by gorilla tourism, for example, right? So these are cases where you have an animal that's very, very prominent, very famous, that people care a lot about. And we're working through this relationship, strong bond, to then gather funds that will help conserve other species that might not be up there with the gorillas.
It's really fascinating. What interests you the most about this problem or its solution, Diogo?
For me, the most exciting thing when it comes to thinking of this gap, really this attractiveness gap between species and its impact in species conservation, is how we can use tools from fields like marketing, for example, to reduce it. You know, the narrative that we build around it and really getting to know and understand our own biases as a species. And so that's really what I think captivates me around this this issue.
Diogo Verissimo has studied the plight of ugly animals, or you put it more fairly, the attractiveness gap in the conservation world. He's a fellow in the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford. Diogo, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
Musician and environmental activist José Condé wants to raise awareness about all the animals around his home in Costa Rica. Here's José telling us about a song from his most recent album.
You are listening to a song called Grito Ambiental, which loosely translates to mean the earth scream. Allá en medio de la selva, ya cuando caen las nubes y las cigarras comienzan su preludio orquestral. It's a song I wrote inspired in Costa Rica by the place itself, by cicadas, who are annoying to some people, but to me very musical and otherworldly. And as the sun is going down in Costa Rica in the mountains and the mist is rising, it covers the valley. So it looks like you could almost walk across the valley. It's a very magical time. And the sound of the cicadas lift and fill most of the soundscape. It's just a beautiful thing. Now, there's also a lot of talk about UFOs and alien sightings in this area. So in my song, I chose cicadas, frogs, and aliens as the characters. And the three characters at one point get together and have a chat. I imagine the cicadas, the frogs, and the aliens greeting each other with the local greeting, and I'm not really too specific on what they're chatting about. It's sort of inferenced, but the local greeting is basically, woo! So in my song, that comes with a melody, and this is how
the frogs, the cicadas, and the aliens greet each other, and how they begin to discuss the ills of the earth, and perhaps things that we need to do, the things that, maybe they're discussing some of the things that humans do to the earth. You know, my song is a hopeful song, so by the end of the song, I envision everybody singing this chorus and joining together in the name of preservation of the earth.
That's Cuban-American musician Jose Conde talking about his song Grito Ambiental, or Earth Scream. It's off his latest album, Souls Alive in the 305. We've been exploring the animal kingdom this entire hour on the show today. Let's now consider the frog. They croak, they jump, right? Well, in Brazil, there's one frog that just doesn't fit the mold. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
They're called pumpkin toadlets, and like their name suggests, most of them are orange, bright orange.
They're cute frogs. They're just adorable.
Rick Esner is a zoology professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. He says pumpkin toadlets have a cartoonish look with
big black eyes and kind of a grumpy looking face.
Basically, they're perfect for the internet. But if you blink, you might just miss them.
They are really tiny. The smallest one that I worked with was about the size of a housefly.
Esner says some are bigger, if you consider a centimeter to be big. This itty-bitty size is charming, sure, but it leads to one problem. Pumpkin toadlets are the worst jumpers of all the frogs Esner has ever seen.
It's quite impressive how bad their landings are.
Their landings are so bad that people on the internet have put videos of them to epic fail music. Upon takeoff, everything seems fine. Their hind legs launch them into the sky. But midair, things go awry. The pumpkin toadlets freeze, their limbs straighten, their whole body stiffens. And like a crash dummy, they fall pitifully to the ground. These landings are the subject of Esner's recent studies, which he conducted with a team of international researchers. He says it's not a cognitive issue, but a balance one.
When the semicircular canals of the inner ear gets really small, it doesn't function as well. And the animals use that information to control their posture in midair.
Pumpkin toadlets aren't getting that information, so they just stay in their launch position until gravity finishes the job. Don't worry. Esner says no toadlets are harmed during these failed jumps.
Small things typically don't have problems with breaking bones or doing damage.
Just like squirrels can fall out of a tree and be on their merry way. As for pumpkin toadlets, they mostly crawl around the forest floor. They only attempt jumps as a last resort to escape predators. Esner knows these little guys are more than endearing and hilarious to watch. They're also relatable.
You see an animal like that that doesn't do athletics very well, that might strike a chord. At least in my case, it reminds me of myself in gym class.
Next up, Esner and his team want to study juvenile pumpkin toadlets. They're even smaller than their housefly-sized parents, and I'm sure, even cuter. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Thankfully, you'll never, ever bump into our next creature, Nure-onna. What is that, I hear you ask? Nure-onna is a yokai, a creature from Japanese folklore. The fictional semi-human, semi-animal inspired indie rock musician, Sasami Ashworth. Sasami, as she's known, took a deep dive into the world of Japanese spirits on her second studio album, Squeeze.
Nureyana is a yokai character that has a woman's head and a snake body, and they're a water-dwelling creature that washes their hair. And, you know, like all folk tales, there's kind of different tellings of it, but the one that I think about the most, she's washing her hair in either the river or the ocean, and some sailors come and bother her, and she hands them a bundle that looks like a baby. And my interpretation of it is that it's kind of this test of morality. And if the sailors or whoever passes by decides to discard the bundle, it turns into a rock, which weighs them down and drowns them. And then she sucks their blood.
Wow. Some of the old Japanese prints of Nureyana are seriously scary. I mean, she's got this bright red tongue. What drew you to Nureyana in particular?
Yeah, I just made my sophomore album called Squeeze, which comes out on February 25th, and it's kind of playing with all these duplicities of beauty and horror, kind of harmony and dissonance and harshness, and I was really attracted to the duplicity of Nureyana and how she is, from the surface, like if her head is just floating above water, she just looks like a beautiful woman, but she's the furthest thing from a victim, which is kind of the more historical tale of a femme character. She's this villainous creature that it completely holds her own. And in my projection onto her, she also has this kind of morality that I find to be fascinating and beautiful.
One of your collaborators compared you to a satanic Brian Wilson. I mean, it starts to all make sense now with this Nureyana connection. I don't want to get literal and impose meaning on your music, but the track Feminine Water Turmoil, was Nureyana the starting point?
Yeah, so when I was finishing my album, that was one of the last songs. I had already began to collaborate with Andrew Thomas Wang, who did the cover art. And he's a really incredible artist. He's worked with Björk and FKA Twigs, and he's a Chinese-American, also from Southern California, and he does a lot of work with Chinese deities and Chinese folktale characters. So we really bonded over this Nureyana character, and so I kind of wanted to make one piece that was a bit of an ode to Andrew and our collaboration and an ode to Nureyana. And also, it's kind of a track that connects the last song, which is about nature, with the rest of the album, which is kind of about human nature. And so I wanted to have a mercurial kind of floating feel.
Right. So it then transitions into Not a Love Song. That's the last track on the album, which is also really beautiful.
I could hear a song ringing in my ears, so down for my love to hear.
Music from Sasami and her latest album, Squeeze. We hope you enjoyed our Labor Day special devoted entirely to animals, creatures we love, creatures we fear and admire, or the ones that just make us laugh. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Just a beautiful, beautiful sound. A beautiful